Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bruno Shirley, a co-host of this channel, and today we'll be talking to Evyatar Shulman about his new book, Visions of the Buddha, Creative Dimensions of Early Buddhist Scripture. Tari, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
It's such a delight to have you here and be talking about this book. I've mentioned this to you before we started recording, but I'm so excited about it. I think it offers such a profound and innovative argument about like how we should be reading Buddhist scripture generally, and the Pali Canon in particular. I am 100% guilty of doing all the things you sort of warn us against in this book and skipping over the sort of boring narrative parts to get to the proper philosophical stuff. And this has really radically changed the way that I read, at least. So it's a stunning work.
Thanks a lot. But just to say, I'm just as guilty as anyone. And when I was getting serious about kind of doing philosophy or especially studying early Buddhist philosophy, I began to realize that there's something wrong with the way we're approaching the text, that we're just reading through what the authors of the text were trying to do and what they actually left us with. And then just picking up the passages of our choice that happen to fit our particular interests and look good in like some logical sequence we fancy, and then put some argument together. And I just realized that the method didn't work, that there's a different level that the texts are working on, and I wanted to uncover that. In a sense, the book is kind of tracing my path of investigation in order to understand what the texts are. And hopefully this will be followed eventually by a study also of early Buddhist philosophy that it's like a methodological backdrop in order to analyze anything we want in the text, not only philosophy, and also, for example, sociology.
So before we really sort of follow in your footsteps on that path there, I was wondering if we could start maybe by just talking a little about who you are and how you came to be interested in this general topic of Buddhist literature. You mentioned you started with the serious philosophy. So what was your path to get from there to here, or even to there in the first place?
Yeah, so, it's kind of hard to understand how karma is calculated or to put it more simply, how I made it to do what I do. I was a young student in the university, very kind of interested in big questions, just still trying to figure out who I am and what I'm supposed to do. And I was studying psychology. It was really boring. Didn't say anything about soul or meaning or truth. And suddenly I almost chanced upon Buddhism. I started studying Tibetan just so it would be something exciting enough to get my mind going. And then from there, it was a pretty slippery slope. And I was writing my papers, like my seminar papers at the advanced VA level on Buddhism, and then I kept going into an MA. And by the time my MA was finished, I just had to read Nagarjuna in Sanskrit. I hadn't studied Sanskrit by then. I was working in Tibetan. And so that's what I did for my PhD. And so my early work is very philosophical. My earlier publications are on Madhyamaka. Some people still identify me more as a Madhyamaka scholar. By the time I was done with that, I never even published that as a book because I was kind of running ahead to this Pali world. I kind of was beginning to realize that in order to really understand Nagarjuna, I had to understand what the Buddhist project is more generally. And then that kind of led to my first book, Rethinking the Buddha. The subtitle says more about what it is. It's early Buddhist philosophy as meditative perception. In a sense, it kind of anticipates the arguments in this book on a philosophical level, in a very initial kind of way. So I basically coming through this philosophical approach and then realizing, as I said earlier, that the next step would be to figure out, before that, actually, there's another sub-step. I realized that in order to understand the philosophy, I got to understand what they mean by Buddha. It's not such a self-evident category. Buddha is not just a prince who grew up here and there and went through those kind of idealized stages of his life, right? I mean, the traditional story begins with him in Tusita heaven, and the gods ask him to be born. So these are not just, addition to historical account. I don't think the tradition cares much about the historical account to begin with. That's kind of part of the argument in the book here. Buddha is in a sense the very truth of being. He's kind of like a god. He's not a god technically, but God with capital G, in the kind of way that any other Indian god would be God, like Shiva, the manifesting in reality. I'm not saying, there are different ways to articulate this, but being this kind of deep principle of the Dharma, of truth, of the correct way to live life. And so you have to understand that if you want to figure out what the philosophy is aiming at, what the practice, what the meditation is aimed to bring about. And then in order to kind of really get my mind around, or my heart or something around this concept of Buddha, I realized I got to understand what the texts are. And that's what kind of brought me to this project. There's something very interesting about it because there's an inner statement about the dynamic that moves the tradition. I think it's more important than the details. Probably have an opportunity to say a bit more about that, but maybe a little later.
Yeah, so you've moved from the philosophy to the Buddha to maybe literature or narrative, which is the focus of this book. And maybe that's a good segue. What is, perhaps at a very high level, the overarching argument of this book? What kind of intervention are you making in our methodology, our way of reading here?
Okay, so that's a big question.
Start you off with an easy one.
Yeah, right. So there are different ways to kind of to provide an answer. The question is, what are the texts? It's true that, and there's a side that I'm taking a literary approach. The word literary comes up a lot. I'm speaking about narrative and the importance of narrative for understanding the message of the text, for understanding the project, for understanding what early Buddhists did with texts, what it was for them. We can't just, take the philosophy as would fit our world and forget about the whole context about what these people cared about. I mean, we can, but then we're not really understanding. It's not thick understanding. It's superficial. So one thing that I'm doing is that maybe that's like the simple answer is that I'm emphasizing the literary dimension of the text. They're telling stories. Actually, a point, I don't think this comes out well enough in the book, is that they're really, really good at telling stories. There's an adept ability to hit the mark with stories about the Buddha and to move audiences and authors, right? The authors are kind of telling a story that moves them no less than it moves their audiences. And so there's an emotional key that the tradition is kind of trying to hit. And there's a beauty involved. It's kind of easy to miss. You know, we're all familiar with this experience that we read the text and we're kind of falling asleep because they're repeating the same statement again and again. But once we kind of understand that it's just like a method and we kind of learn how to pick up the project, we're like not just trying to get at the philosophy. So then we can see all these subtle moves that they're doing. Okay, so that's one thing. Okay, and I think it's been underemphasized. The way scholars have been reading is they wanted, I mean, there's always this assumption that the Buddha was a philosopher. He provided a moral teaching, some guide for practice, different kinds of meditation, and a philosophy. Theoretically, I mean, people don't like to say this anymore, that anything beyond that is just like propaganda or something, or kind of concessions to popular sentiment. We don't hear that as much as we used to, or don't read that as much as we used to, but that's a kind of assumption, I think, that still lurks in the background of the way many people approach the text, both popular audiences and scholarly minds. So a simple answer is I'm positioning the literary before the historical mode. The texts are not trying to tell a story. I guess maybe people understand that, but the historical approach or the historicist approach just kind of misses the texts. And trying to get at them for the history, trying to read them for the history and the philosophy misses the history and the philosophy, because a lot of the philosophy is in the narrative, and a lot of the history is in the way these people created the text and experienced them and the kind of experiences they were trying to generate. So that could be maybe the easier answer to your question. And there's also a more specific answer in the context of the way these texts have been studied in the field in Buddhist studies over the past, I don't know, want to say 100 years, but certainly since the 50s, 1950s, the approach that compares the different versions of the text, the Pali to the Chinese, to the Sanskrit when it becomes available, or the Tibetan, or now we have Gandhari, and this is like the big boom. And when I kind of became a Buddhologist, so in the early 2000s, there were these Gandhari manuscripts being found, and then now we have these old texts, maybe almost 2,000 years old. We can compare it to the other versions. And where is this taking us? So the assumption is that we get back to the early version, the true version, the original version. And so my argument, in a sense, is that it's time to stop this grasping at origins, that each text is a legitimate version in its own right. Making a valuable Buddhist statement within its own cultural context, or maybe a more specific scholastic context, or I don't know, it could be a kind of study group, or just the inspiration of a particular author. There could be many different elements involved here. So in a sense, that's the argument, that when we read the text, there's a lot to find there except for the original version. In fact, the original version was maybe never there, because the texts, I don't think, were fixed in this way. They're more like potentials or grids for a certain kind of articulation, not necessarily a performance. That's a theme that maybe needs to be addressed specifically, and that there's basically another simple way to say this is that there's a creative element involved in the shaping of the texts, that people are trying to create different kinds of experience that they valued and cared about, aside from articulating a philosophy or a kind of theory of the path and practice, that there's an aesthetic dimension. This creative dimension I speak about it as being literary. In many cases, I speak about it as being literary. This doesn't mean they're writing text. Of course, this is an oral culture. But it means it's kind of like a storyteller would perform in a traditional context, or like an author, you know, a kind of Shakespeare or Cervantes or anyone like that tells his story. And there's that kind of element in the text. And in that sense, actually, this is true about many religious traditions. And the Buddhist case isn't all that special. But then this creative element is also about investigating the inner potential of the text, investigating their conceptual world, exploring it, moving towards new experiences. So I guess that was a bit of a long answer. Of course, I have more to say about this, but I hope that works well enough as a kind of basic response to the overall argument.
No, I think it works really well. And maybe then in the spirit of this, I don't know, focus on living texts over originals, it's been a couple of years now since you actually put down the pen on the version of Visions of the Buddha that we have in print. And so I was hoping to ask you, before we get into the details of it, if you'd like to reflect on maybe the conversations you've been having since, the talks you've been giving, the way your ideas are developed, since committing this particular version, if that makes sense.
I like the way you frame that. It really resonates the kind of point I'm trying to make. Yeah, I guess I don't know exactly when I finished the book. And of course, there were different versions. But basically what happened, what I haven't mentioned so far is like, there's, in a sense, the heart of the book is this theory I call the play of formulas for explaining the way, early Buddhist discourses, the suttas, the Pali suttas, and generally I'm speaking about this early level of the literature, and how they were composed, because they always have these formulaic elements, say, Eva me suttam, the sub I heard at one time, the Bhagavan, the Buddha was at this and that place with this and those, and someone came, and there's all these formulaic elements. Some of them are narrative, but also say, if we talk about jhana, these deep meditations, or we talk about selflessness, all these elements are framed in formulas. They always come at us the same way in the text. The texts are repeating the same formulas again and again. So my idea, basically, like the simple idea, is that like these are the basic texts, and then you kind of shuffle them around. An author could shuffle them around, and how this would happen is something we could kind of conjecture and guess when and how this happened, if he was alone or with a group of other monks or whatever. But in any case, the point is that so long as you're basing your new text on these traditionally accepted elements, then almost anything goes and anything makes sense. And the way the formulas are combined can create new narratives, and each one with its own subtle emphasis. And I was kind of hesitant to really say I've got a theory here for how the texts were composed. I was a bit timid, and I didn't want to boast, and I was trying to kind of keep a low key and just kind of raise this idea very gently. But basically, first of all, the response I got from the reviewers was, come out with it. So I did, and this theory and this idea of the player formulas has kind of become an important element in the more important element in the book. So that's what kind of maybe shaped the final version we have in print. But I have been giving a series of talks and talking with a lot of people about these ideas, and receiving very, very good responses from a lot of people I respect a lot. And so today, I mean, if I would be writing the book again, or if I'm thinking about what I'll be moving on from here, I'm not quite sure if that's what you asked me or not. But so if we're speaking about the player formulas, there are different games you can play, different types of games you can play. And the book mainly treats the long and middle length discourses, the Digha and Majjhima Nikayas. But now I'm working more on the Samyutta Nikaya, and further down the road, the Anguttara, and also I'm doing some work on Vinaya. Again, Vinaya, right? So supposedly this is like these kind of Buddhist histories, but then again, they're full of these narratives. And once you kind of open up to this playful element and to the entertaining element of the text, to the fun involved, to the beauty, things look kind of differently. So that's where I'm at kind of at the moment, looking to kind of more confidently articulate this approach to the text and to define the specific methods through which different types of Buddhist scripture can be, could have been back then put together.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you've mentioned that at least in
this version. I hope I answered your question, yeah?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
But I was just thinking, you know, you've mentioned that in this version of the book that we have, you do focus mostly, if not exclusively, on the Digha and Majjhima Nikayas. And that still gives you, of course, a vast amount of text to pull on. You do populate each chapter of the book with really detailed analyses of specific texts. But I was wondering, actually, just in your very first chapter, like your introductory chapter, Welcome Us Into the Book, you focus just on one text, this the Uddambaraka Sutta. And I was wondering if you could maybe start to lead us into the content of the book by talking about that sutta. Like, why that sutta for the introduction? What insights do we get from it?
Great. It really is one of my favorites. But since the point is, you know, we could have done something else. You could have opened up any kind of book in the Nikayas and said, let's start here. And we could have followed the way this text is interconnected with many other texts through these webs of formulas. And we would choose one text and we'd see it appearing somewhere, we'd search it, we'd see it appearing somewhere else, and it would have a different kind of context, and we'd see how that formula is reapplied to suit that particular context. But so the Uddambaraka, in a sense, it's a text I discovered while looking at one formula. I was, and this is kind of how it all began. There's this formula on the way the Buddha meets a rival renunciate teacher. So he's called a parivrajaka, parivrajaka in Sanskrit, someone who has left the home life. And lots of people apparently did this in the Buddha's time. So this is one thing you could do here is kind of map out Indian society as it appeared to the eyes of these Buddhist authors. So these parivrajakas in Pali, right, are very important figures. There's lots of them. And the Buddha meets them very, very often. There's all different kinds of discussion with them. But the point is that he doesn't just meet them in some kind of random way. There's a formalized way through which the Buddha will meet a parivrajaka teacher, or the parivrajaka teacher will come visit the Buddha. And what happens often is, or it happens especially in texts that the Buddha is going to teach something about the values of silence, that we'll be told that the Buddha woke up very early that day, had his meditation, was ready to go into town for alms, but it's just like too early. So he says, maybe I'll go visit that teacher, the parivrajaka, who we've already been told is staying in this and that park, and he's got all these students and whatever, usually 500 students. And then the next thing they tell us is that these students are incredibly noisy, and they kind of have this very kind of beastly behavior, they would say, for an ascetic. They're sitting there and they're shouting and yelling and making all this noise, and they're talking about women and about politics and about armies and about cars or chariots, that would be, and all this gossip and about kings and whatever, you know. So you know, this is like not the true behavior for a renunciate. And the Buddha is nearing them, and the teacher spots the Buddha, and the teacher says, the teacher kind of shouts at his students, his followers, telling them to be quiet because the Buddha likes quiet, and maybe the Buddha will come visit them. And so they quiet down, and the Buddha comes in, and he gets up to greet him and welcome him, and says, it's been so long since you visited us, and offers him to sit on the high seat, the prepared seat. That's basically his seat, the teacher's seat, and he sits to the side on a lower seat. So, and then they have whatever exchange they want. It actually doesn't matter all that much what's going to happen now, because we've been told such a good story. The point has been made. The Buddha's a top teacher. Everybody wants to study from him. All other teachers will basically accept his preeminence as the best articulator of the Dharma. And they want to learn from him, and he can always teach them how to improve their practices. And this is like going on again and again and again, because it's not just some kind of chance fact. It's a metaphysical fact, because he's got the ultimate understanding of cosmos, of any possible fact in reality. Like for the authors of these texts, he knows we're talking now. He knew back then or something, or he's, I don't know where he is now in a sense, but he knows everything. In a completely comprehensive sense. And so I was interested, this is like kind of the first formula that caught my mind. This is, I think I talked about it in a conference maybe 6 years ago or 7 years ago that Natalie Gummer and the late Louis Gomez organized in Berkeley in the Mangalam Institute. And I talked about it back then. And then I was, you know, looking at all these different appearances, and I found it in the Udumbarika. But before it, there's a different kind of formula in which a follower of the Buddha wants to go and meet the Buddha, but he realizes it's too early again. So this is called, that was the too early for alms formula. This is the too early to come meet or see or take darshan of the Buddha. And the student will come up he'll realize it's too early that they're in meditation, the Buddha and the monk, so they'll go meet the teacher. And then we get this whole element, and then they're, again, they're noisy, and in this case, the Buddha student sits to the side because he's a householder. His name is Santana. And then the teacher says something kind of insulting about the Buddha, and of course the Buddha shows up miraculously, and now we'll get the whole formula again of the way the Paribhajaka meets the Buddha. So this is what I call the play of formulas, right? The too early for alms formula, or too early to come meet the Buddha, they appear in many contexts. They're a way to frame a discourse. And here, the Udumbarika is playing with the formulas. It's adjusting them to this context in order to create the specific encounter it wants to create between the Buddha and the Paribhajaka. And by the time we reach the philosophy of the text, so much has been going on. And this is the philosophy of the text, that the Buddha is the ultimate teacher, and that all other religious experts in India acknowledge his preeminence. And then there comes teaching, and there's more to say about the way the discourse developed, but it basically echoes, in a sense, it brings out the Buddha's ability to be quiet. He knows true quiet because he's cleared up all these inner kinds of, these upakilesas, these kinds of inner dirt. That's like an example of the way these formulas, they can be taken apart and put back together and combined with each other. And it's not like the, you know, if they were trying to give us some reliable version of the Buddha's biography, so I'm sure there were different ways that he met Paribhajaka teachers. It wouldn't always come in these formalized ways. And then what turns out is that there are specific formulas for specific characters, for Paribhajakas or for different kinds of Brahmins. And then theoretically you have this kind of, I haven't gone through like the whole corpus trying to identify all this. It's a lot of work. It's one of the places I'd like to continue with this project, is to identify all the literary characters in the Nikayas and see the formulas that define them. But also there's like these formulaic molds of sequences of texts that you can have, like narrative designs that also are also relevant. So that's the main kind of point I bring out in that first chapter. And there's another point, which is that there are different versions of this text, right? I mentioned earlier how scholars like to compare the different versions, but I won't go into the details here. They're very kind of specific, but say that one event in which the Buddha is coming in and the teacher comes to greet him. So in the Chinese counterparts of this text, it's framed very differently, and they say different things. Like they don't want to like in one case, the teacher is he like expresses this conviction that he's not going to get up. But when the Buddha comes, he's like overpowered by his majestic presence, so that he gets up and greets him in any case. So, you know, you're not going to say which is the true version here, what was added and what was distracted. You see, and I mean, this is something you just kind of look at. You need to look at carefully in comparing the different versions. And here I was assisted also by a research assistant and helped me look at the Chinese versions. You see that each version is a world of its own, creating its own kind of sets of meaning. The Chinese texts incline towards these kind of more magical capacities of the Buddha. The Pali is very interested in like decorum and social relations. So that's pretty much, yeah, I guess if I can make a precis of the chapter, that's pretty much it.
So I do obviously want to ask you a lot more about maybe the purpose of both the decorum formulas and the more magical formulas we see in the Chinese. But I wonder if this is actually a good place to ask about formulas themselves. You offer a really lovely explanation of what you mean by formulas in the book. But perhaps for the benefit of our audience, what is a formula? How long is a formula? What counts as a formula?
Okay, so a formula can be, a formula. We all live by formulas, right? We started this talk and you introduced me and, you know, I thanked you and all that. And that's just the way, you know, we're used to making these formulaic exchanges. So it's not only about Buddhist texts, but in Buddhist texts, when you say evam suttam, that's what I heard, you know, that's already a formula. It means a fixed element, a fixed verbal sequence that is reproduced in many texts, or often within a text also. So evam suttam can also connect to evam suttam, etam samayam, bhagava, and I could keep going. At one time, the Buddha was staying in this and that place, and it can be a very, very long formula, say in the Samanyapala Sutta, which is place of the second text in the Digha Nikaya, the discourse on the fruits of being a samana, of being a shramana, that is a recluse. It's a very, very long text, and it has a very long formula that gives the, it's called the Anupavisika, the sequential, the gradual training, where someone would realize that the Buddha is the supreme teacher. So that in itself is a formula, but it just opens a very, very long formula, after which that person who realizes this will decide to leave the home life. And then there's all the different elements of morality that he practices. It's very long. Some of it is kind of humoristic, but ultimately it's saying, it begins with these more ethical elements, and then he also doesn't sit on high chairs and things like that, or he doesn't play backgammon or different kinds of chess, or he doesn't do somersaults. And it keeps going, and after this ethical element, there's all these kind of preparations for samadhi, including satipatthana, reestablishing of mindfulness, including guarding the senses, contempt. There's more than nivaranas, and then he enters jhana. And so this is like, you know, this goes over a couple of dozen pages, and that's a formula. It's a fixed formula, which they don't always repeat between texts because, you know, they also like to shorten things and to get on with it. But then this is something I show in the second chapter of the book, is the way this particular formula is adapted to the narrative context of each text. So normally a formula will be like about a paragraph, but sometimes it will be combined with other formulas to make a sequence. So it's basically, you know, really the best analogy I have is Lego. There's different, you know, just like my kids play with Lego, and there's blue and yellow and red and green and white pieces, and they're different lengths, and they can combine and be taken apart, and you can make different things with them. That's, you know, formulas just done with words that are memorized, and they're also an encapsulation of a teaching, but they're also an image of a teaching of some social figure of the Buddha. Does that answer?
It does. And I'm so glad you brought up the Legos. I really love that analogy in the book. So you make the case for this play of formulas, looking at the Uttambaraka Sutta in chapter one. Chapter two, you sort of expand this approach in some ways, it seems, looking at the Silakandavaga of the Majjhima Nikaya. What do we get out of perhaps reading across several shorter texts rather than the sustained focus on one text as in chapter one?
Well, I mean, in this case, for example, like what I just mentioned, the Silakandavaga, that's the Digha Nikaya, you can see the way the formula is reapplied to each literary context. But you can also take another text, it's a very beautiful, very, very moving kind of story about this monk, Mahamoggallana. He's a magical monk, and he goes up to heaven and shakes Indra's Sakka, that is the king of the gods, palace, because he won't share with him the teaching that the Buddha has given him. So you see here, like in this one kind of very beautiful literary crafted formula, you see here how the story, which is like a myth, is also a kind of symbolic representation of Mahamoggallana's meditation with the god realms as a kind of states of bliss that he experiences in meditation. They're not to be seen here. They're as I said at the beginning, they're very, very good, very capable storytellers. They're always doing more than we expect. And we shouldn't be just kind of catching at the content, at the external kind of manifestation of their way of thinking in the text themselves. There's an inner dynamic that is more important to them, and that's this dynamic of formulas. And in a sense, that dynamic itself is a kind of teaching of anicca, of impermanence, of conditionality, paticca-samuppada, of the way things, of anatta, right, selflessness, the way things kind of come together and fall apart, and there's just no essence anymore. You're just kind of traveling along this vast web of formulas, and grasping and origins would just kind of be missing the point.
We're all caught in Brahma's formula jala.
What can we do? Right.
So I really wanted to ask you in a little detail about chapter 3, when you talk about mindfulness of the Buddha is really a central concern of many of these formulas. And it's something you've indicated already. You're talking about sort of relations to Brahmins, the Buddha is the supreme teacher. But I think it's in chapter 3, you really make this case that mindfulness of the Buddha is a central concern of many of these texts. Would you care to speak a little to that?
I'd love to. And in a sense, that was kind of the basic understanding. And talking about all this stuff about, it's like I'm talking too much because I have too much to say. But in a sense, you know, that's the point. Like the texts are kind of, you could call it meditative practice or contemplative practice or just imaginative method of imagining the Buddha, mindfulness of the Buddha, Buddha Anusmriti or Anusati. Trying to tell me beautiful stories about the Buddha is like a major goal of what the tradition is doing. You know, we're not going to get enlightened tomorrow. The more we connect to the Buddha, this is like the point where I assume the authors were thinking, the more we connect to the Buddha, the more we kind of absorb the Dharma, the more we observe his path and his instruction. And then kind of imagining the Buddha has always been a central element of Buddhist practice. This is very apparent in early Mahayana and later in Tantra. And specifically, I mean, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is exactly the text that the scholars like to read it, you know, in an overly historical way, looking for, as if it matters, you know, where he went from town to town. The point is that he said goodbye from each town, and each time he went there was the last visit. And this is this deep metaphysical point. This is the last time that this enlightened presence was at this particular place. And so the text is a very sad text. It's an attempt to say goodbye, to cope with the loss, and saying that the Buddha was here, and then he moved there, and then he moved there, and then it's circling in on this place where he dies, and all the magic around his death, and the first time that he says, "I'm tired, I'm going to lie down, I'm going to sit down, and then I'm going to lie down," and then he lies down for the last time, and it's an incredibly moving story when we listen to it, even though it's like copy pasted from everywhere in the canon. The whole text is just like reproducing formulas we have in other places, but the way they're kind of strung together in this mindfulness of the Buddha practice of saying goodbye to the Buddha and imagining the way he left the world. Tells us a lot about this Buddhist textual project.
So I hope you won't mind me maybe jumping around the book a little bit here, but I just really wanted to zero in on one really interesting argument you make, actually in the next chapter now I think about it, chapter 4. You're talking about folklore, you even have this idea of Buddhist fun. And obviously these are categories which are often overlooked in Buddhist studies, particularly sort of early textual studies, other than arguments about orality, the parallel theory. So what do we gain by renewed attention to folklore and to thinking about Buddhist texts as being folkloric?
Right. I was hoping you were going to ask me about that chapter because, you know, might as well, you know, rather than being so dramatic and metaphysical and emotional and all this narrative stuff, you know, let's have some fun, you know. What do we miss if we miss out on that? We miss out on the fun. And we miss out, I mean, again, you know, on the more kind of theoretical level, we kind of miss out on what the texts were for these people. Now, I'm not saying all they're doing is trying to have fun. You know, if you have some kind of, you know, deep teaching of anatta, and, you know, someone's realizing it, you know, it's not just like some kind of entertaining moment, you know, we're going to have a laugh as if we're watching Netflix. But some of it is the Netflix of or the primetime TV of, I don't know, say the 3rd century BC in India, in this Pali world, in this early Buddhist world. And yeah, that's what they were doing. I mean, this is a pretty hilarious story, you know, the prime episode, maybe I shouldn't give a spoiler, you know, until we have something kind of funny and wild in Buddhist texts, and it's in, you know, this academic book, you know, maybe let the readers meet it, but there are funny stuff there, you know. Maybe I'll give like the second best highlight there. So the Buddha predicts that this naked ascetic, you know, imagine this guy is a naked ascetic. He must be like an idiot. Of course, this is what the Buddhists are thinking, right? And they want to bring this out. But these are also ascetics. And some people think that they're very, you know, serious practitioners and they're going to be enlightened or something, or they may be already, you know, beyond attachment. And the Buddhists are saying, you know, these guys, they don't know a thing. And so the Buddha, he predicts that this, like one of these naked ascetics, a chelo, is another kind of parivajika, that he's going to die of, what is it? Is it a kind of dysentery, or is that the next guy? I'm kind of getting confused. But anyhow, he knows he's going to die within a week and that he's going to be reborn in a really kind of bad destination. And so his follower, who's the Buddhist student also, goes and warns him and tells him, be careful about what you eat and whatever. But, you know, what can you do? The Buddha's predicted it. It's like a spell. The Buddha's words in these texts are like they have a special power. It's one of the questions embedded within this text is what happens when the Buddha says something? Is that just a description, or is that like creating the definite possibility that this potential event will take place? And so, of course, the guy dies, and his follower, his supporter, like comes rushing to the charnel ground, and he picks him up, and he punches him, and the corpse gets up, and he's rubbing his back, he's like dizzy, and but what can you do? All he can say is confirm that the Buddha's prediction about his inferior rebirth was correct, you know. So, you know, you figure this kind of story, and there are others like it. This is one of the things I've been looking at since then. You know, there's all these dramatic suits. So this is, you know, this kind of pretty funny event. Not all this stuff is funny. This is like a good example of a funny text. But there are other dramatic suttas. You think this may have been staged once, you know, it could have been brought people to have a good laugh. And I think, you know, you asked about folklore. You would expect, you know, I mean, just take the Bible or the Quran or any religious text. It's absorbing, you know, the imaginative world of the people, of the society in which the text took shape. And you know, we call it folklore. I don't think that there's such a deep divide between religion and folklore. Religion, in a sense, is institutionalized folklore, in which like the most wonderful supernatural stories we have that say something about our history are kind of given a canonical status. But on a more simple level, you know, this is like, you know, the kind of stories people like to tell. And I think that's part of the context in which these texts were put together. And one of the concepts that I'm kind of left with moving on with this project, which was kind of laying the foundation, the book kind of lays the foundation for a new way of reading, for a new approach to the text. One of the concepts I'm really left with is just storytelling. Storytelling, inversions, It doesn't mean that the texts are recordings of performances or outlines for performances, but they certainly relate to these performances. And that's something I discuss in that chapter, which is pretty funny. And I mean, I don't know how funny I write things, but the story is funny.
Well, Tari, obviously there's a lot more in the book we could talk about. I'm conscious that we've taken up a lot of your time, but I just wanted to ask you, perhaps we could wrap up. What's the one thing that you hope that our field takes away from this book, methodologically, theoretically, or just having a good laugh at some funny stories in the Pali canon?
That's a real question. I talk too much about all this stuff, and of course there's more to say. I think it kind of bottles down. I mean, you know, they're big questions. You know, we write all these books and we read all these books, and what are we doing in the humanities? What are we? I think, you know, one of the things we're doing is to empathically reach out to the people we study. Even if they're in the historical past, it's also trying to understand ourselves. And if we're understanding ourselves as just or humanity, as if, you know, there's all that matters is, I mean, if history is about the facts and these external events and not about people's hearts and minds and the cosmos, the inner cosmos they created to live in, the world of meaning they generated. And that's kind of what I'm trying to, I think. I mean, I'm not quite sure what the one thing I'm after or I want people to join me in searching for, if that's it. But I think that's kind of coming off kind of the top of my head. I think that would be it. It would be to be able to imagine the world of the early Buddhists in this case, and generally the people we study, certainly in Buddhist studies, as, you know, real human beings with hearts and minds, and to try to understand what they really saw when they saw reality, what their seeing was about, what their experience was about, what their consciousness was like. Some of this is, in a sense, like getting into the dynamic that's within the text is meant to take us closer to the real people there and to their world, rather than kind of coming at it from the outside and you know, getting stuck on the facts, which sometimes can also be important and relevant, and we can learn from that approach too.
That is a fantastic ending. Thank you so much for that thought. And thank you so much for joining us on the Buddhist Studies channel today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thanks so much, Bruno. I really appreciate this. And it's really fun talking with you about these materials.
All right. Until next time.
Bye-bye.